I would make a comment as an addendum to what we had covered last time, which I made in private, you might say, to some few people who were standing by the desk after class, but I think it is a significant point. We had sort of ended with the fact that Jesus, when he came into Jerusalem, and he was greeted by the crowd with the palm branches and the statement, Hosanna, blessed is, well, let's read it exactly so I don't corrupt it. In John's Gospel, John chapter 12, verse 13, that they took branches of palm trees and went forth to meet him and cried, Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that comes in the name of the Lord, that they were acclaiming him as Messiah. Even though he had not said anything in terms of words, they were acclaiming him in that fashion. Part of it, of course, had to do with the cumulative effect of his ministry, because as he had gone about that ministry, many people had speculated whether he might be the one or not. In fact, even remember John sent his disciples to him saying, to ask, you know, are you the one, or do we look for another? You know, are you what we are expecting, you know? And so therefore there had been a lot of speculation, but now there seems to be an outpouring from at least a sizable group of people, how many we couldn't say, who are acclaiming him as such. But it wasn't just because of the resurrection of Lazarus, though that, of course, was one of the major things that excited the imagination of the people, but also the fact that Jesus entered the city riding on the colt of an ass. Now you might say, well, then why did that attract attention? Undoubtedly, lots of people came into the city riding on animals. You know, why should he stand out in that way? Why should they read something into it? Sure, Zechariah has a messianic prophecy. Behold, your king cometh to you, you know, riding on the colt of an ass. But why did they associate it with Jesus rather than somebody else? And the answer is that yes, you could ride into the city on the colt of an ass or on a fully grown one or any other conveyance, but not when you came in for the Passover. I don't mean just the Passover day, but when you entered Jerusalem as a pilgrim on one of the three pilgrimage festivals, you did not ride. You walked. It was just the way you did things. You did not enter the city riding. You entered by walking. Thus fulfilling, even if it's only in the last few steps, the literal term of a pilgrimage festival, which is a hag, well, in plural form, the pilgrimage festivals, chagei raglayim, which is the festivals of, you know, feet. You know, you walk up to Jerusalem. Even if you only accomplish it by the last few steps, at least you enter the city in this fashion. And therefore, by him choosing to ride in as a pilgrim, this was a very visible statement on his part, though not made with words. It was a symbolic thing, but which the people immediately saw, and they became quite excited, because for a long time, maybe many of them had speculated, maybe he is the one, but he's never said so publicly. Then the news of Lazarus' resurrection. And now here he is coming into the city as a pilgrim, riding on the colt of an ass. You know, it's all coming together. He is the one. Though, of course, they were very mistaken in what they expected. They expected him to raise his banner against the Romans and summon the people to war. And, you know, they were getting very excited in this vein. They didn't understand what was going on. Okay. We go back now to our handout. And item number two, which we had mentioned about Annas, that after this interrogation of Annas, by Annas, I should say, of Jesus by Annas, that once he found he could get nothing out of him, Jesus was not going to review everything that he had done and said and taught on this particular occasion, we find the conclusion of this interview with Annas, where it says, Annas therefore sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. Now we come to the third incident in this chain of events. Jesus is interrogated at the house of Caiaphas the high priest. Now this is a major event, and it has caused a great deal of controversy. Naturally, those that are believers in the inspiration of Scripture, have felt that these accounts reflect collectively what took place on this particular occasion in the house of Caiaphas. Some Jewish authors have written ridiculing this account as hopelessly inaccurate, given the legal procedures of the day, because they have maintained that this appears to have been a meeting of the Sanhedrin, the large body where they were not only interrogating but judging Jesus, voting on whether to what sentence of judgment to pass upon him, and that it was illegal for the Sanhedrin to meet at night and deliver any judgment. And therefore, this could not be historical. I think that Solomon Zeitlin is correct, and I think the same point is made by Schoenfield in his book, The Passover Plot, though I'm not certain, that what we have here is not so much a trial, a formal trial, but a interrogative session. You might compare it to a grand jury hearing of the matter, or what we might call a preliminary hearing before the actual trial, when you're seeing, do we have enough evidence to proceed? For instance, right now, the Night Stalker, Ramirez, is going through that process in the courts, and who knows how long it's going to take, which is just a preliminary hearing before even the trial is set. And that would not have violated, you know, existing legal procedures. It is also interesting to note who it was who was present at this particular nighttime session. And we have to be very careful that we don't misconstrue who was present because of the use of certain of the terms. Okay, let's go through this event, and I will ask you to highlight or note certain things. We'll follow first Matthew's account, and then take a look at some of the things that are different in Mark, including one critical statement in Mark which appears in none of the other Gospels, which is tremendously important. Okay, beginning then in Matthew's account, they that had taken Jesus led him away to the house of Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. Now the scribes and the elders, we have to be very careful of what that means and implies. Now the chief priests and the whole council sought false witness against Jesus. Okay, they're seeking false witness to what effect? That they might put him to death. Very important phrase. They sought false witness against Jesus that they might put him to death. And they found it not. Although many false witnesses came. Now that seems to be contradictory. They were seeking false witness against Jesus, but didn't find it, but yet many false witnesses came and testified, in other words. So what does that mean? It seems to be hopelessly contradictory. It says, but Jesus himself held his peace. Now you see, this is where we have to look at Mark's account, because Mark includes the critical phrase that explains the contradiction, showing it's not a contradiction. Going to Mark's account in verse 55, now the chief priests and the whole council sought witness against Jesus to put him to death and found it not. For many bore false witness against him. Well, then why didn't they find it? But their witness agreed not together. That was the problem. See, according to Jewish law, as given in the Torah, a person can be convicted, and we'll see of what crime specifically they were trying to convict him, of this particular crime, only out of his own mouth, or upon the testimony of two witnesses, two or more witnesses. Now, the oral law specified that it must be more than just two witnesses who say, yes, I heard this man commit this crime. They have to agree in their testimony. In other words, under the oral law, they said, we've got to be very careful that we don't condemn somebody improperly. that it's not enough just to get a multitude of people say, yes, I heard him break this law. I heard him commit this crime. They must give testimony, and their testimony must be identical. They must give the same testimony. Otherwise, you cannot convict. Now, what is the crime that they want to convict him of? No, not initially. But what crime are they first seeking to convict him of? It has to do not with his messiahship or any possible claim to messiahship. Neil? Claiming to be Messiah is the same thing, because Messiah means somebody who's going to rebel against Rome. See, so that's the same thing. Kirby? Yes. You see, it's right here in the text, deliberately, they sought false witness against Jesus that they themselves might put him to death, that they would have no need to go to Roman authority. They had the right to kill a blasphemer. For example, can you name one that's mentioned in the book of Acts who was accused of blasphemy and was killed by them? Yeah. Remember, under the Roman administration, they were allowed to administer most of their own laws, including the laws against blasphemy. The only time they had to go to the Romans in a civil case is when one of the parties of the case was a Roman and insisted upon a Roman hearing, like Paul. He was arrested in Jerusalem and would have been arraigned before the Jewish leadership, where he sort of certainly would not have gotten a fair trial. He would have had a kangaroo court, you see. And then when he heard word that, of course, they were planning to assassinate him anyway, he told the captain of the guard, who had him under sort of honorable protection, that what was going on, and so he took him for safekeeping to Caesarea, and he demanded his hearing before the governor. That was his right as a Roman citizen. Now, that was one classification when you had to go to the governor. What was the other classification when a case had to be taken to the governor? Right. Whether Jew or Roman citizen, if it was a case of treason, then it had to be heard by the governor. But you see, well, they're trying initially to avoid that. They are trying initially to avoid it. Why? Why attempt to find evidence for blasphemy rather than just saying, hey, this guy either is claiming to be the Messiah or people think he is. That's a case of treason. We will see if he will admit to messiahship. If not, anyway, we've got enough evidence of the people at least looking upon him that way. We'll take him to Pilate and let Pilate handle it. Why are they trying to avoid it to find evidence that they might put him to death? What is the advantage to them of proceeding in this fashion? Mark? Okay, because even in Caiaphas's comment initially, we read in chapter 10, at that point they didn't seriously believe that Jesus was claiming to be Messiah. That's why he phrased it the way he did. It is expedient that one man should die for the people, that the people perish not. In other words, he may not be claiming to be Messiah. We've never heard him do that explicitly, but the people think he is, and that's what counts. He's too dangerous because he's exciting the people. So better, even if he's innocent of messianic, pretensions, it's better that we put him out of the way than the people should get out of hand and bring destruction on all of us, you see. Of course, they would feel more comfortable about it if he claimed to be Messiah. Then, of course, they'd say, well, we're just doing what we're responsible for doing, handing over somebody who is a rebel against Rome. You see, we can solve our consciences that way. But there's another reason why they don't want to go that route. They don't want to accuse him before Pilate. Why do you think they don't want to accuse him before Pilate, if they can avoid it? Not just that Pilate might find him innocent, which of course was a problem and almost did, you see. And we'll come back to that very important scene later. Gary?
It would be a bad reflection on them and not
control. No, I mean, they would have seized a ringleader and done their job. The Romans would have been pleased with the fact that they'd been on duty and caught this guy and handed him over before trouble happened. But after they'd handed him over, what kind of a situation would they then have on their hands?
Passing the time of year, if it handles this way,
Okay, that's one reason. Anything else? That blasphemy is an advantage in their hands. Look at it this way. If they succeed in convicting him of blasphemy, what advantage do they gain? Yes, Mike. Right? Plus, how could anyone continue to support and defend this man if he has been properly convicted of blasphemy? They'd be supporting and defending a man who is a blasphemer. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. How can anyone who thinks of him as Messiah continue to think of him in that mode if he has been properly convicted of blasphemy? It undercuts any popular support for Jesus. Anyone who would continue to support him would be shunned by the community. You support a blasphemer? That the court ruled this man committed blasphemy against God, and you support this individual as a person sent by God? You know, people would shun such people. And nobody would blame the priests, you see. If they could convict him of blasphemy, they would get rid of him, undercut the growing, swelling movement that was being created in expectation that he was the Messiah. That would die down immediately. And they wouldn't have to have, you see, might say, a problem of public relations with the people, because the people would accept their judgment. You know, oh, if he was a blasphemy, I thought he might be Messiah, but if he was a blasphemy, it couldn't have been. Okay, I'm glad you did that and saved me from backing somebody that God would never have supported. You know, that would have been the attitude of the people. So they sought these false witnesses to prove a case of blasphemy, but they could not prove it because the witnesses did not agree together. Now, there is another way you can prove blasphemy, that if the person himself commits blasphemy out of his own mouth in your presence, in the presence of the court. And this is why the high priest says to him, and this is very interesting in Matthew's account, which is, Mark just says he asked him and said to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Matthew's account is a little more full. It says, the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of God." Now, you really have to combine both accounts to understand what was literally said by the high priest. It seems that what the high priest really said was, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of the Blessed." In fact, if you we'll come back to this a little bit later, why did he say the Son of the Blessed rather than the Son of God? What is the importance of this, "I adjure you by the living God"? Because this is known from the legal sources in the Talmud as a formal way of putting a question, of putting him on oath, so to speak, that he must say the truth. Otherwise, if he says anything which is false, that takes God's name in vain, he has broken the commandment, he has become a blasphemer. That's why it was important that God's name be introduced. He was saying, "I am insisting that you," in essence, say the equivalent, you know, we say in our courtroom, "so help me God," you know, this is the so-called formulation. "I insist that you make a statement linked to the name of God, whether you are or are not what we are asking, the Christ." And of course, if he made a false statement, then he would be guilty of blasphemy. Now, Jesus said to him, "You have said it. Nevertheless, I will say unto you." Now remember, up to this point, Jesus had been quiet. He had said nothing. Jesus held his peace. You know, we find here in verse 63 that throughout all the proceedings of the false witnesses and so on, he said nothing. If he had kept his mouth shut, they could have done nothing whatsoever. But he opens his mouth at this point. But notice how he opens it. It's sort of like that confrontation between the Herodians and the zealot Pharisees, where they were trying to trap him in his words, and he neatly avoided it. "Nevertheless, I say to you, henceforth you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." You know, he didn't answer the question. We look at that and say, well, of course he answered it. He said, I'm the Messiah. Because we understand that what Jesus is saying is something that pertains to the Messiah. They did not. If you've done your homework on the apocalyptic literature, you realize that the figure that they understood as the Son of Man was a completely separate individual from the figure they understood as the Messiah. The Son of Man was a pre-existent, semi-divine being who existed in heaven and who would come and save them with the power of God, you know, from their enemies. That the Messiah was a human being who would walk on earth as a human being and be a human deliverer. And so when he asked him, are you the Christ? Are you the anointed one? Are you the Messiah? He was asking him, are you that human son of David, the promised deliverer? And he answers and says, I am the pre-existent, in their way of understanding, I am the pre-existent son of man. Of course, he was both. But they didn't understand that the thing could be, the same person. He was claiming to be a pre-existent, at least in their thinking, semi-divine, if not fully divine, being. Because what is he quoting? What is he quoting from? By making reference to himself as the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. And why say power? What does he mean when he says power? If you look at the companion scriptures, which are not here, I regret that, I probably should have added it. It says, I think in Luke's account, the power of God, Luke says. Matthew just says, of power. Mark says, of power. John doesn't even report the conversation, and Luke says, of the power of God. That's what it meant. But you see, just as today Orthodox Jews will never say God's name, they will never say Yahweh or Jehovah. They will say Adonai, the Lord. Or they will say Hashem, the name. And even in English, if they write on a piece of paper that is going to be thrown away after its initial use, in English, the word God, they will write G-D. They will not write out the whole word, even in English, the word God, lest they give offense against taking the name of God in vain. Because if you write it on the piece of paper that you're later going to throw away, you're treating it with a great deal of disrespect, you see. That's why a portion of the Torah, which contains God's name, if it has to be, it's worn out or something, it is buried. It is not thrown out, you see. It has to be treated with a great deal of respect because it has the name of God spelled out on that parchment. So it was very common for people to use euphemisms for God. One well-known euphemism of this period was power. And so what Jesus is doing is using a euphemism. He is using a euphemism for the name of God. Now, he had been asked by the high priest to make a statement using God's name. Now, Jesus knew no matter what statement he made, they would not believe it. They would regard it as a lie. And if it was said with the name of God, they would then conclude he was guilty of blasphemy, even though he wasn't. He was telling the truth. And they would have executed him accordingly as guilty of blasphemy by stoning. And that was not the prophesied death he was to die, you see. So even though he could have said it and been truthful, they would not have regarded it as truthful, and that's what counted. They would have convicted him wrongly, but they would have convicted him of blasphemy, and they would have stoned him. And so he makes this statement, which to them was outrageous, that he claimed to be not just even the human Messiah, but the pre-existent divine being that they knew of as the Son of Man. But he says it without linking it with God's name. He uses a euphemism deliberately, and thus technically did not commit blasphemy according to the law. Now you say, well, didn't the priest say, but haven't you, you heard what he said? Have you heard this blasphemy? This is not to be understood in terms of legally being the case. It was blasphemous in the sense of being outrageous. Have you heard what this man says? This is outrageous. You see. That he's even gone beyond claiming to be the human Messiah. He claims to be a pre-existent divine being in the bargain. And that's why, in conclusion, they answered the rest of this group, he is worthy of death. He deserves to die. In other words, maybe we've been kind of hung up on the idea that perhaps we were railroading an innocent man for the sake of saving the nation. But now we don't have to even worry about that. I mean, he deserves to die. He's certainly claiming even more than messiahship. The point is, if he had indeed committed blasphemy, they could have done what they wanted initially, which was to stone him. But they don't. Therein lies the proof he had not committed it. Instead, what do? The only gospel that tells us this crucial fourth event is Mark's. And it's said in such a way that perhaps it's not noticed what it is. Straight away in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council held a consultation. Look at the wording of that. What seems curious about that? Especially compare the wording of Mark 15:1 with the wording of Mark 14, verse 53. And Matthew 26, verse 57. Look at it carefully. Do you notice the difference? As I say, if this wasn't drawn to your attention in this comparative fashion, you probably would read it and never see the difference. Because it doesn't seem to be a major distinction unless you do an eyeball-to-eyeball comparison between Matthew 26:57 and Mark 14:53, which are essentially the same, and Mark 15:1, which is very different. What's the difference? What do you see that is different, Alan? Yeah. That's why I said we have to be careful of wording, that we don't misconstrue what wording means. Normally the term scribes, of course, refers to the Pharisaic leaders. And the elders, of course, are the tribal elders that are the other component of the great Sanhedrin besides the priests. You have the priests, you have the elders and the scribes making up the great Sanhedrin. But if it's this whole group that has met at night, and then they meet again in the morning, why does it repeat these identifications, priests, elders, and scribes, and then say, and the whole council? It seems like a useless redundancy. But therefore, it's not a redundancy. And it's indicative, too, that Mark repeats it after having described in the previous chapter the nighttime meeting where the chief priests, the elders, and scribes were present. So what we find is that this is not the whole Sanhedrin meeting at night. That's the clear implication. Because when the morning meeting is held, it says you have the same people who met at night plus the whole council. You've got a smaller group holding this nighttime interrogation of Jesus, which, as I say, I think Solomon Zeitlin is correct. You've got a preliminary hearing, so to speak, before going to the Sanhedrin to present the case. In other words, originally they hoped in this preliminary hearing to get evidence for blasphemy. They would have gone to the great Sanhedrin in the morning and said, we have evidence of blasphemy. They would have produced the witnesses. He would have been condemned. He would have been taken out and stoned. Or failing that, they would say, we have evidence of this man claiming to be Messiah. You know that's against the Roman law, that we are responsible for handing him over to the Romans. Do you give your consent as the great Sanhedrin that we should proceed? They would have given their consent and they would have proceeded. You see, you've got two different groups. Now, I left one thing hanging here. I should have mentioned it earlier. Why Mark says in the high priest's words, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Because again, that's another euphemism that was common of the day. The blessed being a way of referring to God. Now, there's a question over here. Farhan?
Yes. You know, in Matthew 26:59, now, the chief priests and the whole council.
Yeah, which council? The scribes and the elders of this little council, you see. There is a companion scripture that is very similar in this. And I don't know what happened to my notes for this lecture. I can't seem to find them, so it may take me a moment to find this. It has to do... Oh, here it is. Yeah. Acts chapter 5, we read in verse 12, by the hands of the apostles were many signs and wonders wrought among the people, and they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. Okay? Verse 14, believers were the more added to the Lord, multitudes, both of men and women. This Christian group was growing very rapidly. Inasmuch that they brought forth the sick into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might overshadow some of them. There came also a multitude out of the cities round about Jerusalem, bringing sick folks and them which were vexed with unclean spirits, and they were healed every one. I mean, you can just imagine the excitement as this is going on. This thing is building right under the noses of the Jewish leadership. Then the high priest rose up, and all they that were with him, meaning his assistants, which is the sect of the Sadducees, in other words, the Sadducean political leadership, and were filled with indignation, and they laid their hands on the apostles and put them in the common prison. But the angel of the Lord by night opened the prison doors and brought them forth and said, go stand and speak in the temple to the people all the words of this life. And when they heard that, meaning the Sadducean leadership, heard that they entered into the temple early in the morning and taught, the high priest came, and they that were with him, and called the council together. Which council? You have to read on. And all the senate of the children of Israel. You see, there are two groups that are mentioned. The high priest and they that are with him, his chief administrative assistants, called the whole council together, meaning the little Sanhedrin, and the senate of the children of Israel, which is the great Sanhedrin, you see, for a meeting as to what to do about it. And this is the same kind of a passage as we have here in Matthew's account, where you have Caiaphas the high priest. The scribes and the elders that are mentioned here are his council, the rest of that little council. And that's why in Mark's account in verse 15, it says the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes, which are the Synedrion, and the whole council, which of course is equivalent in Acts 5 to what is called the Senate of the children of Israel. Now, why does it say Senate there? Because that's a term that the people in the Roman world outside of Judea would have recognized more easily, because that was the Roman term, you see, that they could relate to. And just as Parliament in Britain today still serves as sort of a Supreme Court in Britain, the Court of Appeal and Last Judgment, so too the Senate in Rome did, you see. Okay, there's another hand or question here. Yeah. Okay, the council, as used in Acts 5, refers to what we have been calling the Synedrion, using the Greek form of the word, which refers to the little or small Sanhedrin, which is your administrative body that assists the high priest in the day-to-day administration of Judea. Remember that I stressed this earlier in describing Roman government. This is the group that's responsible for maintaining public order, handing over rebels, suspected or proved, and making sure that Roman policies are followed in Judea, so the governor is not such a visible ruler. Then you have the group in Acts which is called the Senate of the Children of Israel, which is the Sanhedrin, as I've been using the term, which of course refers to the great Sanhedrin that includes the little Sanhedrin and the additional members, most of whom are Pharisee-oriented, you see. So as I said, Mark 15:1 goes along with Acts chapter 5, verse 21, in showing these two distinct groups. And therefore, by Mark's own account, the people that are gathered at night are this little group, and in the morning they assemble with their evidence before the whole group. Now, what did they discuss at this whole group meeting? It isn't said. But it must be apparent what they discussed, because their next action must have been approved of by this joint meeting. Their next action was to go to Pilate. They do not accuse him of blasphemy before Pilate as being the chief charge. They blame him of being a Messiah, of claiming to be king, you see. Of being Messiah. This is the only charge that would hold up before Pilate. Now, we can look at this next scene briefly before the bell. The whole company of them rose up and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man perverting our nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ the King." Now, of course, part of that is true, and part of that is a lie. Did he ever say, "Don't give tribute to Caesar"? He had been challenged on that issue and had not said that. He had said, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." That's an outright lie. The fact that he was claiming to be Christ the King is, of course, true. But they're sort of embellishing to make the case even more alarming to Pilate and secure a judgment from Pilate. Now, notice the account in John. They then led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas into the palace, and it was early. And they themselves entered not into the palace, that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" In other words, this is a Jewish man. You are the Jewish leadership. Normally you judge these things in your own courts. Why are you bringing this matter to my attention? You know. They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we should not have delivered him up to you." That seems a bit cheeky to the governor, doesn't it? You know, what explains this rather cheeky response? Because John is an accurate account. He is reflecting the tenor of their answer, if not literally the word-by-word account. The tenor is certainly accurate. Let's keep that in the back of our minds as a question, why they're so cheeky. Pilate said to them, "Well, if he's an evildoer, take him and judge him according to your law." I mean, you Jews have the right of the courts. I mean, why then are you bringing this man to me? The Jews said, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." Now, unfortunately, too many people have misread that statement. It was lawful for them to put a man to death for blasphemy, but not for the crime they were about to accuse him of. It was not lawful for them to put to death a man accused of treason. That was the province of the governor. Pilate therefore entered again into the palace and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Now that's a specific statement. He's saying, in other words, are you the Messiah? Do you claim to be Messiah? Are you guilty as charged? And what does Jesus say? Jesus answered and said, "My kingdom..." Well, I'm sorry, I left out part of the verse where he says, you know, "Indeed, I am a king, for that purpose was I born. But my kingdom is not of this world or this age. If my kingdom were of this age, then would my servants fight." In other words, my servants are not fighting because this is not the time when my kingship begins. And so Pilate is really confused. Here is a man, not unlike others that have come before him, accused of being Messiah. And yet he says, "Yes, I am, but you have nothing to worry about. I'm not making any claim to taking over Roman rulership here. This is not my time to be king." And he says, this is perplexing. I've never heard somebody say, "Yes, indeed, I am Messiah, but no, this is not the time for when I'm going to take over rule." And he really doesn't understand what's going on. And so after a lengthy interrogation, which we're cutting short here, Pilate comes back, as we have in Luke's account, to the chief priests and the multitudes that had gathered in his courtyard and says, "I find no fault in this man. I don't find him guilty of the charge you're bringing." Normally, a Messiah figure is a rebel against Rome and saying, yes, if he confesses, "Yes, I plan to raise troops and overthrow Roman authority." Well, he makes no such claim. I don't understand why he calls himself Messiah then. That's something beyond me, but at least he represents no threat to the Roman dominion. I find no evidence that he has, you know, done so. But they were the more urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee, even unto this place." He is inciting the people to rebellion all throughout Judea. Indeed, he began this in Galilee, and he's continued it all the way up to Jerusalem. Now, this gives Pilate an escape hatch. Because if he is supposedly guilty of the same crime in Galilee, which is an independent jurisdiction, remember, Galilee was still an independent area under the rule of Herod Antipas, he can send him to Herod Antipas for judgment and just let the whole thing stay in his hands and wash his hands of the whole affair, you see. as soon as he heard that he had supposedly committed this crime in Galilee also, that gives him the right to transfer jurisdiction of the case, which he doesn't understand, and he's suspicious as to why it's being brought anyway. And so Pilate sends him to be interrogated by Herod Antipas. Now Herod sends him back with the advice that he doesn't find anything either. So now it's back in Pilate's lap again. It's like a hot potato. He got rid of it and it comes right back to him, you see. And he doesn't have anything to do with it. Now, some have misconstrued that he sent him up to Galilee and then came back from Galilee to Jerusalem. Now, that would be physically impossible in one day. How could he be sent to Herod Antipas and back to Pilate in a matter of maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours? Sure, to keep the Passover. Herod Antipas was in Jerusalem. Very simple. We even know exactly where he was in Jerusalem. A few, maybe about a quarter kilometer away in what had been the palace of the Hasmoneans in Jerusalem. That's what Herod Antipas used as his residence when he came there. And so he comes back to Pilate. Now, we're not going to have time to go through the conclusion of Jesus' trial before Pilate today. But what I want you to do is this. As you read through this in the handout, you will see that Pilate seems to continue to find no guilt. He wants to release Jesus. He sees no reason not to. But there are several curious things in the account. One, maybe you've never noticed this before. Jesus ends up being scourged twice on two different occasions. Why is he scourged twice? Very clear when you put it all together that he was scourged twice. Second, why is it that Pilate caves in and agrees to condemn a man he believes to be innocent? Now, there is a statement from John's Gospel, a threat that the Jewish leadership levels at him, that says, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Even though that threat might have been a meaningful threat, why did Pilate cave in before it? I mean, after all, he was the Roman governor. He represented the Roman governing authority. If he sent a report back, I examined this man, I found no guilt. As Roman governor and upholder of Roman law, I released him. And the Jewish leadership sends a complaint and says this guy released a man that should have been condemned. Who is the Roman government going to believe? Why should he be so afraid of this threat that he caves in? This is something that needs some further review. And so, also see if you can find, you'll find other instances of this sort of cheeky attitude that the leaders are showing towards Pilate. They're certainly not treating him with respect. There has to be a reason why they feel at liberty to treat him in such a shoddy manner rather than, you know, with respect. And therein lies a whole explanation for why Pilate caves in. Okay, yes. Yeah, I mentioned, didn't I go back and say that? The Son of the Blessed was a euphemism instead of Son of God. In other words, again, not using God's name. So more than likely, Mark's account shows the literal word, though Matthew shows the whole legal formulation, which was required by law, that I abjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. That's probably the exact words the high priest said, putting them both together.